listening to Orange County's only station with critical business information, Critical Mass, with Rick Franzi and Doug Feller.
Well, actually, it's neither one of them today here. It's neither Rick nor Doug. It's Paul Roberts from OC Talk Radio. Rick got hung up and wasn't able to get here in time to the studio, so we're going to pinch hit for him here. And we've got a very interesting guest to talk to today. But before we get to that, let me just give you some idea again of what Critical Mass for Business is. Critical Mass is an interesting concept. It really is something I had never seen before, and that is a variety of ways to bring businesses together to help them share information, to learn from each other, to support one another, and to ultimately help one another make better, more informed decisions, as they say. So it does have many components to it. Rick himself wrote the book, Critical Mass, The 10 Explosive Powers of CEO Peer Groups, talking about these monthly forums that they put together where they have people brainstorm and help one another, form a mastermind, if you're familiar with that concept. And his partner, Doug Gefeller, has been doing it for 15 years. In addition to that, is a master certified coach for executives and for companies. So between the two of them, we have a lot of experience with peer groups and with executive coaching. And together they form a company called Critical Mass for Business, which is just that. It provides a critical mass of information. And by bringing people together, creates that mastermind or critical mass of minds helping one another here. Hopefully I've done it justice here today. Our first guest and our only guest here today on the show is a gentleman who I've never met before, but who I'm told is an expert in lighting controls and a variety of other software, hardware. I'm going to let him talk about it, and welcome to the show, Gary. Is it Halmbacher? Did I say that right, Gary?
You've got that right, Paul.
Okay. Well, I tried practicing it four or five times here.
One in 100. That's very good.
I won't try saying it again here. Tell us what is your company, and tell us a little bit about what it does, because I've got the website up. The name of the company is Intellicon, Intellicon. And I'm going to let you describe it because it's still a little vague to me. It says Internet Solutions for Motion and Light. What is that?
Yeah, and we are a design-build manufacturer that services the industrial monitor, industrial measurement, industrial control market. And through that, the reason we have the Internet Solutions on there now is pretty much anything that's controlled anymore. Many customers want to look at it. They want to monitor their equipment. They want to measure its performance, and they want to control it, and they want to do that over the internet. So, where our primary business is still inputs through keypads and outputs through displays, that information can now be transmitted over the internet.
And I think that is a fascinating topic. I read somewhere years ago, and maybe this is one of those futuristic things, that at some point, all of our appliances, all of our machinery, all of our factories are going to be interconnected to one another here. And I thought that was kind of a pipe dream. But again, on your website, it says by 2010, over 80% of all internet communications will be made machine to machine. I thought that was a startling statement.
And I have looked all over for that quote. I remember reading it in a magazine somewhere, and I haven't been able to find it since. I think they may be a little bit early, but what I believe the exact quote was, by 2010, 80% of the communications over the internet will be non-PC type communications.
Yeah.
And while I'm not sure we're there yet, there are incredible numbers of devices that are on the web already, and we intend to be one of the companies that will be in the forefront of that technology.
Well, I'm going to let you get in and talk about that, but I want to make one more comment again, because I just think that is such an amazing statistic. I read years ago, again, maybe like you, that all these, even our home appliances, are going to get plugged in. And the idea was, you get a call one day from General Electric, and you say, yes, can I help you? And they're saying, well, your refrigerator needs repair. And you go, it's working fine. I think it's okay. Oh, no, the refrigerator called us up last night and said there's a compressor going or something like that. I mean, do you see that kind of thing? Is that just fantastic thinking, or is that possible?
No, it's already a reality. There are imagine you're a municipality and you have a I worked on a project as an example. It was in wastewater, and there were machines that had to be, there were tanks that had to be filled periodically. And the number I've heard is it can cost $250 or more to roll a service truck to a certain location. So you can roll the truck, and some of these tanks are demand-based, so you can't just go every week. You have to go every week to check the tank to make sure it doesn't run empty.
Right.
But if you go every week, you may be going more than you need.
And you're wasting gas and so, manpower and running
sure.
your truck and, too much and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, you take that $250. So if you spend even, $400 or $500 on additional cost on an internet solution, your payback could be in a matter of months.
Yeah. So instead, the machine, the waste tank, communicates its level to somebody somewhere, and that's where your company comes in. So do you make the hardware, the little, I don't even know what you call it, the little communicator, the little add-on, the device that connects to the internet, or the software, or both?
Well, I have a very bright friend of mine, and he works for a...
Always good to have one of those.
Well, I have a couple of them, but this guy speaks with an Italian accent.
Oh, then he's really smart.
But he had made the comment, we've had many discussions, he's very high placed in a electrical equipment manufacturer, and he said, Gary, you know, anything you can dream up, any device you can dream up or idea, somebody has probably done that already. And so the value today is not in whatever that is, but for a solution to a customer problem, if that solution involves A plus B plus C plus D, the value is buying the A plus the B plus the C plus the D and being the system integrator or the problem solver for the customer.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And I was a little bit too early. You know, there's the leading edge of technology, and then there's the bleeding edge of technology.
Okay.
And
you did some bleeding before leading, huh?
I had the bleeding edge. As an example, I have a link to a web server, and the web server, as far as you knew, could be a computer somewhere. In reality, the board that's sitting on the web fits in the palm of my hand.
Jeez.
But the technology has advanced so dramatically in the last few years. Instead of developing the board as I did, I can buy that piece now. So the trick is, for a lot of what we do, we already have the control, and the idea is to buy that piece that puts us on the internet, where the information we have available right now that, again, might be on a 7-segment display or some LEDs, you can see essentially a graphical representation of an interface panel, but you see it on your computer.
Wow. So you're sitting in some place looking at a graphical user interface, a GUI, a little thing with little monitors, and then maybe it's got little dials and things showing levels or whatnot. And this machine is anywhere, and it's communicating to you. It's telling you what its current status is.
That's correct. And some people have some problems with it. They're political problems, not technological problems. But in this day and age of computer viruses and spyware program, IT managers, as you can imagine, are very leery of having things on their networks that they don't have direct and complete control of.
Makes sense. I wouldn't even think of that. But you've got all these little soft entry points embedded throughout your factory and your operation here.
And in reality, our devices aren't the problem, because they're typically what's called microcontrollers. They're 8-bit, 16-bit. They have what's called firmware. There is no modifiable program. There is no hard drive. There is the microcontrollers I use typically have less than 64 kilobits.
So there's not much, yeah.
Megabits and gigabits. We're talking kilobits to do what I do.
So you can't download some spyware program into that and infest the network through that.
Exactly. And where years ago, if some of those things went into the chatter mode, they could potentially lock up a network. But in the day of gigabit Ethernet like we have today, where you have voice and data and video, our little 8-bit microcontroller, we could jabber away all day long, and the network would not even know it.
Yeah, okay. All right, so you make the controller, which is some sort of little tiny circuit board that fits in your hand and plugs into the device. But how does that device, doesn't somebody have to write some sort of software? Doesn't it communicate data that has to get interpreted and turned into a spreadsheet or something?
That's correct. And years ago, one of the points we decided to talk about was significant events. And I started my life. I went to General Motors Institute, which General Motors owned a school back in the day.
I have to stop you for one second because I was curious. I'm from Michigan myself.
Oh, you are.
I've lost the accent, but I still detect it in you here. So I still get some of that gosh and gee, a little of that Michigan accent there. So
interesting. Yeah, I'm a born and raised in Detroit guy.
Yeah.
And again, went to General Motors Institute and worked for a place called Chevrolet Gear and Axle, where we had 13,000 workers.
Sure.
And we're talking late 60s, early 70s. And at the time, Detroit in general, and GM in particular, there was no more efficient manufacturing machine on the planet.
No, that's
General
for sure.
Motors.
That's for sure. Or research and development team. I mean,
right. There were so many technological innovations they and the other auto companies had. It was phenomenal. And I was there during that time. And when you looked at a factory, what you would see is you had a plant manager, and if you were on the assembly line and nut A did not go on bolt B correctly, the manager of the factory did not come down and solve that problem.
Yeah,
The worker could solve the circuit. He could either throw bolt B away and put in a new bolt, or if he really had a lot of problems, he would call a foreman over.
Mm-hmm.
Then there might be, you know, some department head that might get involved, and only if the problem got really serious did the plant manager get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the early days of computing, when they were very expensive, computers tried to have the plant manager see if there was a problem with nut A and bolt B.
Mm-hmm.
And what's evolved over time is the control measurement industry has gone more to a factory organization where the products I build can handle most problems up to a certain level before they say, hey, you have to get somebody else involved.
Right.
And that's where Intellicon came from, intelligent control.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was we would manage our local system. As an example, I have a major place in the vent hood industry. So I've got, if you ever get to the McDonald's in Red Square, my equipment's in the vent hood.
The Red Square in Moscow. Okay,
yeah,
your stuff is there. All right.
My equipment is literally worldwide in a number of vent hoods. There's a new, it's the largest cruise ship that's ever been built.
Yes, whatever that's called, something.
Oasis.
Yeah. The Oasis, okay.
So the equipment is on there. If you end up in the fashion show mall in Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
if you go into pretty much any restaurant in there, this pollution control equipment is in there. And what it uses is ultraviolet lights, ultraviolet C with ozone production. And what it does is, if you've ever been in a restaurant that's been around for a while, you look up at the vent stack and there's just this ugly black grease that runs down off the top and onto the roof.
Know exactly what you're talking about. It does go onto the roof, and it is like a thick tar that gets spewed out.
And worse than that, a few things. Well, you think the odor is nice if you come up and you smell hamburgers. If you live in the area and you smell that every day, not so
yeah,
much.
Yeah, right.
Beyond that, there's a huge fire hazard with all that. Once that catches on fire in the duct, you can't put it out, and
yeah.
It's not unusual to burn a restaurant down.
Yes, right.
So this system, through the use of my electronics, are an enabling technology, if you will. The lamps do the work, but something has to run the lamps.
Well, I'm going to stop you again. We seem to have a lot in common. Not only did we both grow up in Detroit, my father worked for the automobile industry. He was an executive for Chrysler Corporation and made me go work in these factories during the summer,
mm-hmm.
and see how ugly and awful and all the stuff that they do to make these cars. Of course, that was way before robotics or something. But I've also been involved in the restaurant industry quite a bit through the years, and can absolutely testify. I didn't know there was anything that could stop that. I know there were various sorts of scrubbers or other things that would try and capture that they came up with a few years ago. But I never heard of ultraviolet radiation to zap it. Now, I have heard of ultraviolet being used for bacteria control. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit, because isn't that controversial? You know, don't they want to use it like at Albertsons and grocery stores with vegetables, and people are scared about it or something?
Well, there's a couple different technologies. If you go into ultraviolet, UV, UVA is what you get suntans with. UVB is what you get sunburns with. And UVC, which is a higher frequency radiation band, is what you kill things with.
Right.
And beyond the meat, it's taken a major place in the water treatment industry, in that, as you probably know, the water industry for years has used chlorine.
Yes, right.
Both for potable, or in other words, drinking water, and wastewater.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of years ago, the EPA declared the chlorine itself as a pollutant. It creates things called chloramines that in themselves are carcinogens.
Mm-hmm.
So all new water treatment plants are being built with UVC.
And I knew that. I'm going to give you one other strange connection. One of the other, my principal background is marketing, and I've worked a lot with restaurants, and I've worked a lot with other industries. And one of the industries I've done a great deal with up until recently was the hot tub industry. Hot tub industry has taken a real fall over the last year or two, but for a number of years I've worked with Sundance and Dimension One and Coleman, all these companies. And they're in that industry, they've been slowly trying to adapt UV radiation to radiate the water, and just as you said, get rid of the chlorine, because it's nasty and it's harmful, and people don't want to use it anymore to treat their hot tub any more than they do their pool or their drinking water or anything else.
And what a lot of people don't realize, you know, you heard about World War One and the gas attacks.
Yes.
A lot of that was chlorine gas.
Oh, I never knew that. Really? That's what they were?
Mustard gas and chlorine gas.
Yeah.
Chlorine gas is a very nasty, nasty gas. It even if you live, it scars your lungs forever. And if we have chlorine plants, which we do, a lot of these tanker cars you see in railroads are chock full of chlorine gas, chlorine liquid.
Mm-hmm.
Where if the tanker gets loose, you have a potentially deadly situation.
A toxic cloud that spreads as that tanker cracks open out on the railway.
Oh yeah, so chlorine and you know, we thankfully don't hear much about the problem, but it costs money to make the chlorine, transport. Not that UVC is free; it takes electricity, but it's a very efficient kill mechanism. In fact, it didn't get used for a lot of years because the UVC doesn't actually kill the organism. What it does is it renders it sterile. So for a lot of years they thought, well, geez, we see a lot of the organisms floating around. Maybe this isn't the best way to do it. And then they realize that the organisms that are left can't reproduce.
So
then the industry really took off.
Am I correct in my reading that they're trying to use this for fruits and vegetables and other things to eliminate, you know, handheld contaminants? Somebody touches the vegetable and it gets infected and it gets transported with that. And if so, why is that controversial? Or are they talking about some other radiation?
Well, in the spectrum of radiation, again, you go from the visible light, which starts in the red, goes up through yellow, green, so on and so forth, through blue, violet, ultraviolet, which is what we're talking about, UVC.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get past that, you get into X-rays and gamma rays, what we think of as nuclear radiation.
Okay.
And UVC it won't kill people. It can cause temporary and permanent blindness and second and third degree skin burns.
Right. As it's radiating, if you looked at it or touched it or something here, right?
Right. And keep that in mind where you said if you look at it. Well, mm-hmm. once you get it into the higher bands yet, where you're getting into X-rays and gamma rays, that can kill people. So UVC is a great surface treatment. So, yes, if you had a peach, if you had a pear, if you had a piece of steak, UVC would be a great way, and it's much safer than X-ray or gamma ray radiation.
Okay.
If you had, say, hamburger where the surface had contaminants where you ground it up, where the surface gets mixed in with the middle of the meat, UVC is not a good technique, because if the surface wasn't completely clean, it gets mixed into the middle.
It doesn't penetrate to kill that stuff in
Correct.
The middle.
And
right.
That's where the X-ray and gamma ray, but that's, if you remember, the government was X-raying mail or gamma radiating.
Yeah.
I can't remember if it was X-rays or gamma rays for mail, and what they were actually using was systems that had been used for food and vegetables.
So is this controversial? I mean, it seems like I've read people
that
are...
Everybody hears the word nuclear, and they lose their minds over it.
They freak out and think that somehow
yeah.
this is...
UVC is, from that point of view, would be much safer in many ways, and effective as a surface treatment.
Okay, now I'm confused again here, because first you started talking about intelligent control systems, these little chips that are going to get plugged into the internet and tell people if the tank is empty or the part's going bad or something needs service. How did you get into, you seem to be, know a great deal about UV radiation. Do you make systems that radiate things too, or do you just control them?
Well, if you go back to a comment you made, which was you can't look at the light.
Right.
So in the visible light world, if the light over your desk, you know, your drop-in 2x4 fixture, you know, your typical lighting fixture in an office.
Right.
If the light is out, you know it.
Yeah.
So you call the janitor, and he comes and replaces a light bulb.
Oh, I see where you're going.
If you go to look at a UVC light, you're going to have a very bad day or maybe even a very bad rest of your life.
I see. So you can't physically peek in and look at it and say, oh, it's out.
Right.
So something else has to tell you if that's out or not.
You need a remote monitoring system to let you know what's going on.
Makes sense. And so you make that remote monitoring system.
That's correct. After GM is, you know, people take circuitous paths into things. I worked for a company by the name of Magnatech, which was a lighting company.
Okay.
So I was in the visible part of the lighting business, which, by the way, the electronic lighting market is about $1 billion a year, which
sounds
like a lot of money till you realize toothpaste and toilet paper and things is probably 4 or 5 times that.
Okay, all right.
But it's still a lot of money.
Right.
And then there's this segment off to the side that's everything but general lighting. Bus, truck, rail, aerospace, UVC, which is air, water treatment, things like that. So I am in the what I call the non-traditional lighting business.
The non-visible stuff here.
The non-visible, and even if somebody, as an example, I was mentioning Vegas, if you've seen the taxis running around with the three-corner lighted signs on the roof of the taxi,
yeah,
a lot of those use my lighting. Those are actually fluorescent lights in there.
You're
run
kidding.
Run off the car battery.
I didn't think you could run a fluorescent off a car battery.
Well,
okay.
Where I come in.
Okay.
So, in fact, that's where Magnatech had originally gotten its start. A year, and I'm talking probably 35 years or so ago, they had developed some electronic ballast for buses, which ran on 12 or 24 volts DC. So you couldn't use the traditional transformer ballast that required 60 cycle power from the power line, because it didn't exist on a bus. So when electronic ballasts were really, really clever, they came up with a clever way of driving fluorescent lamps back then.
Amazing. All right.
So
now I'm going to.
The company I worked for actually started the electronic ballast industry.
So I'm going to stop you for a second and ask you one of these real stupid pedestrian questions. But again, having been in restaurants, and I've owned restaurants and participated in them, and we always have trouble with our fluorescent lights going out, and inevitably it's that thing called the ballast. What is a ballast, and why does it go out? What is a ballast?
Oh,
can you is that something?
I'm trying to think of the short. The
is it what ignites the gas? I know there's a gas somehow in there.
It does three things in the. That's one of them. Yeah. In reality, it does one of three things. It heats the cathodes, which are like a little light bulb in either end of the lamp, which you see a glow sometimes.
Right.
It then creates a high voltage that ionizes that gas, that allows current to flow in the gas,
right.
And then it regulates the current in that lamp.
Okay. And why do these things fail so often? It seems like in my garage, the fluorescent ballasts go out. In our restaurants, we always had, especially in the kitchens, big fluorescent lights. And that little thing that seems like it's about the size of a quarter or whatever always seems to be the failure point. Is there nothing better than that, or is...
The things in your garage fail because they're kind of the bottom end of the market.
Okay.
Just the lowest possible cost thing you can make. The ballast, which is actually the size of a small brick, is buried up in the fixture. And the electronic ballasts today are quite reliable, and where you have to typically replace the lamp maybe once every year or 2 years if you get any life on it, the ballast could last 7-10 years. They're still taking ballast out of the ceiling that were put in the 1940s.
Wow, really?
When
okay.
General Electric invented the fluorescent light.
And you don't, but you don't make the ballast. You, again, make a monitor that something either controls it or monitors it.
I do both.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I do both. And that gets to be the, you know, the tagline on the business card, which is microcontroller solution, microcontroller and internet solutions for power and light.
Gotcha.
So
okay.
I've been in this power electronic business, but what happens is with power electronics, let's say you need to run a motor. Let's say you need to run a solenoid. Let's say you need to run some displays. Let's say you need to do something with light.
Right.
That all takes power, but it goes back to the A plus B plus C plus D. That's great that you can do that, but most people today need a lot more than that. They need somebody to tell them when to turn the light on. They need to tell them what intensity to go to. They need somebody to turn a pump on and then sequence a certain number of valves, check a tank level, and then control, say, a pump speed to keep the level in the tank constant. And that's where I come in. So
okay.
You can't do one or the other anymore. You really need both.
It has to be the word everybody uses, integrated. It can't just be one standalone. You don't just make the little gadget or controller or piece or circuit board or whatever. You got to somehow be able to put it together as a system, I gather.
Well, this goes to, you know, another area of the talk, Paul, and that's what are some of the things that have changed in the last number of years.
You read my mind. That's where this was going here. You know, what is changing?
Well, what has changed is, you know, a few things. We have, while the microcontroller, well, first off, engineering departments used to be, they used to go on for decades, and it was like a good team. There was a coach, which was maybe a lead engineer, and
mm-hmm.
that person would, you know, people spent their whole lives at one company.
Yeah, General Motors, for example. All
exactly.
my relatives.
Exactly. Yeah, there were people that worked there, you know, that worked there forever.
Yeah.
And what we've done is, we have we had this mentoring system, but today we have divestitures, we have buyouts, we have layoffs. And what typically happens is many, many times the engineering departments are the first things to get blown up. There's unfortunately been a lot in this country where the price of the stock becomes everything. And when you're managing a company for 2 or 3 years, one way to get the stock price up, and I've worked for a couple of companies like that, a way to get the stock price up, get rid of the engineering, drop the manufacturing costs, run production as fast as you can for a couple years,
mm-hmm.
get your money out, and then go on to the next company before anybody sees what's going on.
And then be like Chrysler selling to Mercedes, and then they end up with a burnt-out company that they go, what did we buy here?
That's one of the many examples. Even Magnatech, the company I work for, had a few of the head officers come in and do that. They've got very stable management now. It's been there for a while. They're doing a very good job now. But I watched it unfold before my very eyes. So what you see is that mentoring system breaks down because they may get rid of those high salary people that are probably very good. They can bring in lower cost engineers, but they lose the mentoring ability. They lose the corporate memory. And so what you find is anymore, companies have some ideas and they want to implement those ideas, but they no longer have an engineering department to do that.
So they have to go find some. And would that be you? Would you?
That would be somebody like my company. And
okay.
again, we are an OEM design and build company. So I would go to a company, as an example, Snap-on Tool.
Okay.
If you've had
big
your
brand, we're familiar
engine
with
oil
that.
System flushed, if you've had your fuel injection system cleaned, if you've had your transmission oil changed.
All of those.
Your brake system
right.
flushed. It's probably been done with my controls.
Okay.
They probably don't know. they probably don't even know I exist, but there are thousands of my controllers sequencing that. As an example, the transmission, you have to drain the transmission fluid out of the pan. You have to count how much fluid that is because you have to put that fluid back in.
Right.
You have to sequence the fluid in. You have to tell the user what's happening. There are some timing. There are a number of valves that have to be run. There are pumps that have to be run. There are counters that have to be statused. And then the user interface that lets the customer know how to use the machine. So that's what I specialize in. But again, it can't just be the controls. We have to run the pumps. So I make integrated. One of the products I do is what I call a custom programmable logic controller. And there's a market for what's called the PLC, programmable logic controller.
Okay.
Mitsubishi, Allen Bradley, ABB, Omron. There are numbers of companies that make these controllers.
Okay.
And they have fairly they're almost mini PCs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But the real cost is the integration. That's the A plus B plus C
right.
plus D, but then somebody has to do the system integration. Well, these tools are very powerful anymore. They're only powerful if you know what to do with the tools.
Yeah.
And that's where we come
sense.
In.
Well, that all sounds a little bit over my head. You know, I'm following what you're saying. And in some ways it kind of I'm gonna sound like what they used to call a Luddite, the people that were always against any change in technology, but it's made things so complicated and so interconnected, and I can see the benefits, but it also means that average people can't work on their cars anymore or can't fix things, and there's a level of complexity there that I guess it's good news for you, but bad news for us is just average people. I mean, it seems like these things are getting so complicated that nobody knows how to fix them anymore here. Do you see?
Yes and no, in that as somebody who was a mechanic, as somebody who has been involved in the auto industry for, unfortunately, 40 years now, the only thing better than really complicated to diagnose and repair is you don't have to do it at all.
Yeah. Wow.
And to quote a good friend of mine, when customers would come up and say, boy, they sure don't build them like they used to. And he'd say, yeah, and it's a darn good thing.
So it's a good thing that you don't. No, I hadn't thought of it that way because, you know, one of the common complaints, for example, I'll switch industries here. And I read a comment years ago that Bill Gates said, you know, we still haven't got them so simple that they're a toaster. You know, there's still too much complexity, too many things to plug in, too many things to go wrong. And his goal was to make it the appliance someday is easy to work as a toaster. And the idea was that it's anybody can do it then and it never breaks and you do that. If I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying the whole industry everybody wants to move in that way. They want to make a car work like a toaster. They want to make everything work. Like, they want to make huge machinery work like a toaster so it basically monitors and takes care and fixes itself.
And if you look at everybody talks about the Japanese, Edwards Deming, you know, who had come up with the
yep.
total quality management, TQM.
Who was laughed at in this country and went to Japan only because nobody would listen to him here.
And won whatever the highest civilian award is from the Japanese government.
Right.
But what he came at the very simplest, it was you need to be able to, before you can improve your process, you need to measure where you are. And then as you make changes, you need to measure, you know, how you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about measurement and control, which is the business I'm in. You can't, you don't know if you have a good process or bad process because you can't measure it. And most of the time, when your process is not in control, it creates waste. And waste is cost,
mm-hmm.
which saps profit. So this is really about total quality management should not only save you money, it gives you a better product, but it makes you a more profitable business. But it's about precision. And in, you know, say in the automotive business where I worked in a factory that made axles, it was all about how accurately you can machine things.
Well, right.
The accuracy that you can machine things had to do with the temperature of a machine. It had to do with the wear of a tool. And mm-hmm. you needed a tool and die person to sit there. And, of course, every piece you made changed the shape of the machine, changed the shape of the tool.
Yeah.
All these microcontrollers we talk about that add complexity actually do real-time control. And if you look at, getting back to the UVC system, which I do, I make a good ballast, as do a number of people. This ballast being the electronic lighting controls.
Right.
But with this new generation that's being introduced as we speak, I can not only monitor that lamp to tell you it's good or it's bad, I can tell you how many hours on it, how many times you've turned it on and off, which has to do with lamp life. I can even warn you that it's getting near the end of lamp life. And
amazing.
While that can be monitored locally in the kitchen, now that I have that information available in my microcontroller, I can broadcast that information across the internet, or because, as we mentioned earlier, IT managers are nervous about that, we can go across the cell phone network.
Really? So it doesn't have to be...
we don't even touch the internet.
Yeah, right.
So we can send, you know, a text message once a day saying, I am fine, and it can be like your grandmother. If you call every day and she says everything is fine, everything's fine, or she can say, I have an ache or a pain, or if one day you don't hear from her,
exactly.
That's probably not a good thing.
Exactly, right.
So it's the same in this business. So part of it is you have to understand the business you're in, which I understand lighting and the power electronics aspect of it, but also you can't control or measure anything unless you understand the business. So I've added that component to the business, which is the A plus B plus C, and then the D, of course, is the internet control and monitoring, which can not only monitor the process, but if you can monitor something, again, you go back to the Edwards Deming total quality management of, if I can measure it and monitor it, now I can do things that will improve the process, which
right.
means I can lower my costs,
makes sense.
Raise my profitability, and give my customer a better product.
Yeah, makes sense. Are there others doing this? Are you alone in this, or are there lots of other people who figured out this equation?
I think most small businesses, Paul, are in this. You have to, one of the things you learn as an entrepreneur, which goes back to another company I worked at out here. General Motors was great in that I worked for probably the premier manufacturing company of its day. But what you learned in Michigan, as you probably know from when you were there, go to school to be a good little drone so you can
yes.
work somewhere for 40 years, get your gold watch, and
absolutely.
Retire.
Absolutely. No, I abhorred that. I hated that and couldn't wait to get out of it. My father did that. For 40 years with Chrysler, and my other relatives worked at GM or other places, and that was the model. And it was not about innovation or step out of line or anything. I'll tell you an interesting story. I don't want to get too far off the track here, but when I was a kid, we lived out in the suburbs. My dad was an executive, and so he made me go down into the awful city and see what these factories are like by making me work there in the summer, which was a real eye-opener. It's amazing they built anything. I mean, it was so inefficient.
Well, remember,
and crazy.
I worked at one of those awful factories
you
were talking
well,
about.
Well, this is, I don't know when you were there. I was there, this is like the early 70s when I was there.
Yeah, say, I worked in Chevrolet Gear and Axle 1969 to 1971.
Well, I worked
for there about the same time.
Detroit Diesel, whatever the other Chrysler thing, all of those
right.
in up and down 6 and 7 mile, the stamping plants and the engine plants and all that stuff. And what I was shocked at was that if you tried to step out of line, and again, I'm not going to sound, I don't want to tout in my anti-union horn that was drilled into me at those days.
Right.
But at the same time, I understand some of why these companies failed, because there was a guy and it was his job to put the tires on or something, and that was his job classification. And if somebody else, if he was sick that day, somebody else couldn't step up and do that. So they had to bring somebody in at overtime to do that one function, even though there were three guys standing around, you know, idle doing nothing over here. There was just a lot of that kind of inefficiency in parts that, you know, cars would come out with limping because they put the spare wheel on the front instead of the other wheel because the guy was high as a kite in there or something. And they would just say, oh, move it on and we'll deal with it later. You know, just.
And yet through all that, Detroit was still the most efficient manufacturing machine on the planet.
That's what's
so
frightening.
You can
yeah,
imagine,
right.
like you said, had we kept what we have and moved on with the Edwards Deming, you know, Six Sigma total quality management, where we might be today.
But it was, and I see that happen quite often, where industries get hooked on a process that got them to the top, and then all of a sudden they forget what they're doing and they forget to innovate. And that was always the, you know, when GM started to get into trouble, everybody said, you got too many layers of management, you're too committed to the past, and you can't be nimble enough. You're not willing to change. And they're like, why change? We got 50% of the market. Well, now they're down to 20 or 25% of the market. You know, and unfortunately, there's an awful lot of people, my relatives included, who are out of work back there.
Right, and my a lot of my family is. Well, that's why I'm staring at it right now as I talk to you. On the wall in front of my desk, I have, this is from Steve Ballmer, who knows just a little bit about successful business.
Who went to the University of Michigan, by the way, the same time I was there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And
he was a mathematics major.
What was he? He was number two, I guess, at Microsoft. Right? What, number two or number three, I guess. There was him, Paul Allen, and of course,
Bill Gates, right, yeah.
And at any rate, he said, you know, stage one, invent something. Stage two, get it to critical mass. Stage three, milk it for all it's worth. Stage four, create a culture that allows you to do it all over again, regeneration.
Yeah, right. Well, we're certainly here talking about critical mass. I mean, I will disclose that the way I met Rick and Doug is that I joined one of their peer groups. And believe me, it was the last thing I had in my mind, but I'll give you my little background here. I know this is an interview for you, but I'll share this with you that I had a marketing company, and one of my basic clients were independent restaurants and also the hot tub industry. Well, two industries that couldn't be in worse shape. Rents went sky high, and nobody's building independent mom-and-pop restaurants anymore, me included. And the hot tub industry went, just tumbled in free fall when the economy started to go down. It's the first thing people can put off, and it's the last thing they want to buy these days.
I was going to say, you mean people wouldn't spend money on their hot tub before paying the house payment?
Really
hard to believe.
Maybe at one time, but not recently. So I found myself with a marketing company and nothing to market. I'm in my 50s. I'd gotten lazy and rely on General Motors. I'm doing the same thing over and over again here. And so I had to rethink myself. And I really thought, you know, I need to get out of my isolated world where I everybody I know was in the hot tub industry or the restaurant industry. And I need to find ways to come up with some stuff and to more than network, I need to get some brainstorming going on here. And I stumbled onto this idea of critical mass, of bringing people together. And I thought, I don't know if this is for me. I'm from the Midwest. We don't talk and share too well here. But I got into it and joined it. And out of that was born this idea that, you know, I need to find other ways to offer marketing services. I had always been big in communications and how people communicate their message. And out of this kind of brainstorming in a very weird roundabout way came this idea of internet and internet radio, and thus was born just a couple of months ago this new radio station, which I'm happy to say Doug and Rick brought their program over. They were on another station and came over and are now one of the first programs on my new station. So it is amazing how that all the things you talked about, you can get stuck in a rut. You can get stuck in a mindset and be a nice little robot and follow the path. But today, more than ever, you have to be nimble and you have to be adaptable to change. And that's not easy. And it sounds like you've done that. You started off making one part and realized you had to add B and C and D and everything else to the equation. You know, it's interesting. There's some similar evolutions that we've both had here in this process here.
And I think part of that, Paul, kind of in the same vein, if you're going to run a hair salon, you better have a really clear idea of what you do differently than somebody else.
Yes.
It's not that you won't be a success, but you have a lot of competition.
Boy, isn't that a differentiation. Rick and Doug talked about it a lot. I talked about it a lot in marketing. You can't just be the same thing. If the only thing that's different about you is price, you're in trouble. You need to find something that sets you apart. And that's why I asked the question a while ago, and I'm still not sure. Are there other IntelliCons out there? Are there people that do all these things? Or are there lots of little companies? I make the ballast and somebody else makes the controller and somebody else makes the whatever else goes
well,
into the system.
And that's there are probably tens of thousands of IntelliCons that are all in various niches. And, yes, there are companies that make ballasts. You know, little companies like Philips,
no-name companies, right?
Osram, who is owned, you know, people in this country know it as Sylvania, who's owned by Siemens.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll guarantee you, when they're at their best, they make a better ballast than I do for what they do.
Sure. And they can probably make them in quantities of scale and all this stuff that you're not capable of doing.
You better be able to buy about $500,000 to $10 million a year. So if you have a niche where, say, a vent hood or a water treatment plant, they're not the right guys. They mm-hmm. are the volume guys, and also they're not the microcontroller guys. So they're probably out there. I don't know who they are. I think I'm pretty sharp at it.
Mm-hmm.
There could be better microcontroller people out there. There could even be better ballast people. But in today's business world, you can't just turn the light on. You need to know what it's doing. You
right.
need to know about when it's ready to fail, and you need that information, and you may need to control it based on is somebody underneath the cooking hood, because who wants to waste? You know, we're talking about, you know, energy saving and everything going on, and now I just heard something about the Obama industry is going to put, or I'm sorry, administration is going to pay for smart electric meters. Well,
mm-hmm.
well, this ozone technology, UVC ozone technology, is great. In the time before the breakfast rush, but before the lunch rush starts, you don't want to be running the lamps at full bore.
Yeah, no.
And so all of that, to turn the light on just isn't good enough anymore. As you said earlier, to turn the refrigerator on isn't good enough. It better make ice. It better control the temperature. It better let the repair facility know when it needs help. People aren't satisfied with just a refrigerator doing what a refrigerator does.
Because we didn't care how much it costs to run a hot tub or run a lamp. But now with rates going up and energy becoming more and more expensive, you know, we're suddenly cognizant of that. And, yes, structural. I'll give you a classic example. I see it all the time. You go into restaurants late at night in the hot summer, and it's still hot in there, and everybody's complaining. Well, because they were trying to be cheap and didn't turn their air conditioner on in the morning because they didn't probably have to, and they waited too long, and now it takes that body of air a long time to turn over and get cold. And so, you know, they hadn't planned very well. And so now they're trying to crank it up full bore and try and catch up. They thought they saved some money by turning it off for a while, and now they're trying to play catch-up here. You know, lots of that kind of stuff. It's fascinating.
People think this is something new. One of my workers gave me a great book called The Ancient Engineers, and you can go back to the Persian Empire, and the reason we went from wood to coal and from coal to oil and oil to natural gas, all this had to do with efficiency. If you look at the, whatever, 5,000-year history of man, why we went from tin to bronze, just all of these things, we have made ever more efficient use of our resources. So it's not something new, and it's not something that's going to stop. All of this technology helps us use what is on this planet ever more efficiently.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that gets me upset. I'm going to show my political stripe. I'm probably more of a Democrat than a Republican, but even still, I can't say I'm thrilled with either one of them, because they both get into these endless games about, you know, the world and energy efficiency and all that stuff. And I keep saying, you know, I'm great at it saves the seals and does some other things. But, you know, it really, really comes down to just making the world run better. And as a businessman, being more efficient. I mean, there's so many reasons to go green other than just conscience. I mean, there's some logic to all of this stuff here. It, as you said, because it makes things more efficient. And when people fight these sort of things, I'm like, you know, so I guess we just want to stay back in the dark ages here, but maybe that's our nature. You know, I have a 56 Plymouth and I still can work on it. So somehow I think that's better than my brand new Lexus or something here, because I can't even begin to see what's under the hood. There's so many little controllers and computer chips.
But if you drove that 56 Plymouth every day back and forth to work, you'd really get tired of that car in a hurry.
Yeah, and that's true.
You know, going back to something you said, it wasn't that long ago. It was in a time when I had my first car. I mean, people forgot tune-ups every 12,000 miles. Tires lasted 12,000 miles.
Yeah.
Brakes lasted 10 to 12,000 miles. Batteries lasted a year. It's just the car truly is like a toaster anymore.
Yeah. Oh, it is. I'm sorry to say I drive a Lexus, having grown up in Detroit, but God, these things are so, I'm going to give a plug for Lexus, but it is just so automatic, and it has all these sensors, and it takes care of everything, and it gets great performance, it gets good mileage, I don't have to repair it very often. Yes, when I do, it's a bunch of money because I'm replacing all these computers, but you know, it is pretty much like a toaster. I never think about it. And it runs 100,000 miles before I even have to do anything, it seems like.
Yeah, it's 100,000 miles before you do what used to be normal maintenance every 12.
Yeah, right.
So, and again, all that energy, energy is in a sense waste in that it goes back to the cost equation. So you only want to use as much as you can, which gets to one of the other topics we had about the green industry. And there's a lot of people that talk about this. And to me, going to a rock concert and drinking beer for, you know,
right,
save the planet, that isn't green. We actually walk the walk at Intellicon. If you look at a building from an energy point of view, about 40% of the electricity use in a building, I'm talking like a commercial-type building,
mm-hmm,
about 40% is motor loads. In other words, the motors needed to run the compressor for air conditioning or to handle the air that circulates in the building, that circulates the hot or the cold air for air conditioning or heat.
Okay.
And another 40% roughly is lighting load. So about 80%, 70 to 80% depends on the building, and there are more computers now and so on and so forth. But about 70 to 80% of the energy of a building is consumed by motors and lighting loads.
Some bulb buzzing or whatever, a ballast getting ready to fire here or something. Yeah.
And we are in the business of selling, both designing and selling off-the-shelf motor drives, and also in the business of designing and selling off-the-shelf or catalog lighting ballasts. So Intellicon, pretty much everything we do, we are a green company. We may not be the glamorous company making windmills, but
right,
we are in that business of saving energy.
So that's got to be an exciting field to be in, and more to the point, a profitable business. I mean, you're at the cutting edge. As you said, maybe it was the bleeding edge for a while here, but you're in a position to do what all businesses are having to wake up and do, which is get more efficient.
And again, that's right. The real challenge you have is not becoming successful. It's once you are successful, the real challenge is not becoming complacent. And
yes,
the Detroit auto industry
became complacent.
Is a very good example of that. They were really in many ways victims of their own success. And you
yep.
know, the Chinese and the Japanese are facing it now too. They've had a 20-year slump in their economy. We think
no question about it.
They're
no
on a juggernaut, and at some point, the Chinese, probably a generation from now, they'll face the same issue.
Yeah, it's human nature. I don't need to have engineers. I don't need to change. I don't need to adapt. Things are going great. I just want to hold on to it. My father used to say that life is a parade, and it either walks over you and passes you by or leaves you behind, but it doesn't just stand still. You can't just stand still and watch it. You know, it either leaves you or walks over you here. So is the industry you're in, I mean, we're in a tough time. Everybody's retracting. Are they open to this idea of getting more efficient, saving money, or are they still in the short-term mentality, yeah, I'd love to do that, but I don't have the cash to convert right now?
Well, unfortunately, yeah, there are a lot of challenges right now, Paul. As you mentioned, the restaurant industry, well, we talked a lot about water treatment. My main market right now is the UVC/ozone systems for the restaurant industry.
Yeah, and they're in a real slump these days.
And yeah, there's a lot more of those going out of business than building new ones.
Right.
So there are a number of codes that are in place that require the systems, but I believe in the system. I design a key part of the system, yet when I go to a restaurant and you see the insides of the ducts, it's not like there's a little bit of grease. It's they're spotless. Like if there were fingerprints in there when the thing was built, the fingerprints are gone.
Wow.
It's amazing. You can appreciate it. I don't know how.
We'll have to talk some more about that either in a future episode or offline here, because I'm involved in a restaurant project right now where they already have the hoods and all that kind of stuff in there. I've never heard of such a thing. I knew there were, you know, kind of scrubbers that are just glorified charcoal filters or something to kind of catch some of this stuff before it goes up under the roof. I didn't know there was a way to zap it and to eliminate it.
It's truly magical. When you see it, it's like I said, I've been involved in it now for about 7 years. And I'm still in amazement when I see the insides of the ducts. It's unbelievable.
Well, we're rapidly running out of time here. Anything else you'd like to talk about? I'll certainly give you a chance before we're done here to give you a plug for how they can get in touch with you. But it seems like you've got a lot of information and a lot of innovative systems that you're creating to make restaurants more efficient and monitor them, to make UV systems capable and connected and monitoring. I mean, are there any other areas that I've overlooked here that you want to mention before we end today here?
Really, we'll call it the microcontrol or the local level control of devices that interface with the physical world, be it light, be it motors, be it solenoids moving, you know, to people, whether it's moving fluids, whether it's moving, and the fluid be like a liquid or a gas. Whether something needs to be controlled, a door needs to be opened or closed, windows, so on and so mm-hmm. forth. That is our business. And probably as an engineering, we're primarily a design-build engineering company, as I said. And the biggest challenge is people coming to us, and they, you know, I can't tell you how many people I talk to. Let me know how we're doing on time.
Yeah, this is just a recorded show after this, so we can run over here. Normally I'd be all over the guest to cut it right now, but because it's my station and this is interesting, I'm going to go on a little longer here. So,
and just the point I was going to make, most people think, and I get people all the time, well, have you ever thought of if you could do, and what about this? I tell people, anything is possible, but I've worked with a number of people where the project has just gone nowhere because they come and they think they've done 95% of the work because they've thought of the idea.
Yeah, well, of course, right. That's,
and in reality, the 95% of the work is the implementation. Is it going to be plastic? Is it going to be metal? Are you going to machine it? Are you
right.
going to stamp it? Do you have distributors? Do you have, how are you going to sell it?
Yeah.
All these things aren't looked at. And it was one we worked on. It was a bed for invalids, and the guy, hey, I'm not going to do anything. I've thought of this idea. I would like you to develop it for free. And then I'll let you bid on it along with some Chinese suppliers when
yes.
it's done.
Right.
Well,
you set the bar, and then I'll go have them make it for cheaper.
Right, because I did all the work.
I'm
allowing you to get in and do freebie work to implement this. So when you find somebody that really understands, okay, I have the idea, but I really need a design and development partner, and somebody can manufacture it, that's us. But then I need to make sure as a small business, because typically I have to invest in these projects,
right.
my time and money,
right.
same thing. And I have to make sure, does this person have the wherewithal? Are they in the industry where maybe they understand how they're going to go to market?
Right. And can they market it?
Can
they do the marketing necessary? Can they craft a message and convey it to people? You know, a good product, the oldest adage in the world, build a better mousetrap in the world of beat it past your door. Doesn't work anymore if nobody knows what a mousetrap is and where you're located and why it's so great. I mean,
and yeah, a lot of it, I'm not a big fan of marketing surveys. You can do some, but marketing surveys gave us the new Coke.
Yeah, right.
Marketing surveys said FedEx was a really stupid idea.
Yeah.
so sometimes you have to take a shot. You have to do
I
the
agree.
Best you can, but the real entrepreneurs out there are taking a shot. They're spending their time and their money working with some other people, and sometimes things hit, sometimes they don't.
Well, I guess when I say marketing, I'm thinking more of the communication part of it. It isn't, I agree. I think we're over-marketed to death, even though I do marketing. That's never
right.
been my thing, where we're always trying to, sooner or later, you just got to have the cojones to go out and try something and do it. And you have to have some feel for what it is in the industry. I think some of that is just the old-fashioned gut instincts that we don't rely on enough of. When I think of marketing, I think of what we're doing now, ways to communicate to the world that you exist. And what's exciting to me, I'm going to give a plug to my radio station here to be in this, is that like all these things on the Internet, whether it's a blog, whether it's Twitter and Facebook and all these other silly things, it is a way that you can communicate directly to your customer. That's never happened before. If you came to me 20 years ago and said, we got a great product and great company, we want to tell the world about it, we'd have to buy an ad. We'd have to convince a local newspaper to write about you. We'd have to do, there's some intermediary to reach them. Now you have the ability, and again, it's scattered, so there isn't just one place that you can go get everybody to listen to you. There isn't just one soapbox to stand on and have the whole world hear you. So it doesn't immediately bring you an audience the same way the mass media used to, but it does let you build an audience to go out and talk to people as we're doing here today. And hopefully you'll take this and put it on your website and send it to people. And, you know, it's more than just a one-shot thing here. It's the technology allows us to record these and capture them and repeat them and replay them and download them and spread them. I'm not sure we've all figured out how to use this yet, but the potential exists for anybody in the world, you and me, to not only find customers using the internet, but to communicate back and forth with them. And that's the challenge. You know, it can't just be a one-way conversation. Here I am, come buy my stuff. You have to actually talk to people today.
And some of this is just, if you have any initiative whatsoever, I mean, this is a truly exciting time to be alive with the internet, business I have, the development tools.
Yeah.
Even, and I made the point, I have a cousin who is a real Luddite, and said, well, I need to go into the woods of Vermont. If you hate technology, technology allows you to hate technology. You can go into the woods of Vermont and tap trees, maple trees, and make maple syrup and sell it to the world. And it, you know, again, yep. The technology that person so hates allows them the ability to get away, up to a point, get away from
to
it.
To live off the grid simply because the little connection you maintain to the grid will make you money in the middle of nowhere.
And that never existed before, as you said.
No. No, I'm a big believer in technology. Maybe I didn't sound like it early on because I get the car stuff frustrates me, but maybe you've convinced me. There is some benefit to all this. But
Your Lexus allows you, the fact that your Lexus is so trouble-free and it costs so little of your income, it allows you to have a second car, which 30 or 40 years ago would have been considered a luxury.
You're absolutely right. I'm sounding more and more foolish as I complain about the good old days here. You know, they weren't so good.
And I bet on the internet for your, what was it, 56 Plymouth, you
56,
said?
56, first year of the Fins.
I bet you are on the internet all the time looking for 56 Plymouth parts that you could never have found 20 years ago before the internet.
You got me here. You've nailed me here on this one. Well, this has been very interesting to talk about. I hope that the people listening to this show got as much out of it as I did. And I hope that they will contact you if they have any desire to do custom lighting and measurement controls and all these other kinds of connectivity things that you do. How do they get in touch with you
number
if they want
ways
to know more?
They can reach me either text or telephone me at area code 714-679-9749 or my website, and unfortunately it's a mouthful. It's Intellicon, the name of my company, Intellicon,
okay,
then the word electronics, plural, .com. So that's Intellicon. And unfortunately, I named that before, in the early days of the internet,
right,
before I realized that's not a good idea.
That's not a name everybody's going to instantly
recall. Yeah, it doesn't
recall.
Exactly roll off the tongue.
Right. Not like OC Talk Radio. See, that
right.
is, that's something.
I fooled around with a tagline of "We move you" because we do not write software for computers. We are not a computer gamer company. Everything we do with our micros is going to make something in the physical world happen. It's going to change the speed of a fluid, the direction of a fluid. It's going to turn a light on. It's going to do something with a motor.
Right.
It's going to do something with a door. So we interface with the real, you know, with the real physical world.
The real mechanical stuff.
We are not a virtual reality software company, anything like that.
You make something tangible that when you send a command to it, it interfaces with some piece of equipment, machinery, something, and does something to it.
That's correct.
Right.
Or informs you that something happened.
Right. It's somehow talking to it or touching it or whatever. Well, fascinating stuff. I wish you all the best. You know, I'm sure that as the economy rebounds, you're going to find yourself positioned at the forefront of a very exciting new world here, where everybody's going to have to suddenly rethink the way they do business.